Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I'm just going to jump right in to the first part of a chapter called Slow Escape from the book Goodbye Jesus, written by a former Baptist pastor. That man's name is Tim Sledge, and I'm going to speak to Tim in just a few minutes. Tim said in chapter 86 of his book, he said, "Why did I stay so long in a belief system that is so obviously not true? How could I keep my eyes closed for decades to such evident fatal flaws in my faith? I'm not stupid, but that's how I felt once I finally let myself think without restrictions. At times, looking back on how I lived and what I believed is painful because it feels like an admission of a wasted life. So how does a person like me stay so long in an unreasonable faith? Part of the story may be genetic. We may have evolved to favor a less risky position on faith, a sort of better safe than sorry approach that's about survival. Imagine a primitive man walking alone across a field. He hears a noise behind him. What is it? It could be an animal about to pounce, or it could be the rustling of the wind. If he assumes the noise is danger and responds in a way to defend himself, he's more likely to survive, whatever the source of the noise. If he doesn't prepare for the worst and assumes it's just a gust, he's at greater risk of being killed. Those who respond to the possibility of danger, whether it exists or not, are more likely to survive and thus to pass their genes along, including this trait. The relevance to contemporary Christianity? If there might be a hell, then assume the danger exists and take evasive action. Embrace faith. It's called Pascal's wager. If you're betting on eternity with your life, act as if God exists because you have less to lose if you're wrong. Even if we accept the hypothesis of a genetic component, faith is about much more. Once established, faith plants deep roots. A broken belief system is hard to leave, especially when learned during formative childhood years. Its inconsistencies are easy to tolerate when faith provides meaning, security, and hope, all of which are tough to abandon when you're linked to a community that keeps reminding you, you're one of us, you're not one of them. We are okay, they are not okay. Leaving us would be the worst thing you could ever do. If we cannot make some sense of life, we may be tempted to give up. To keep going, we may opt for a set of not-so-good reasons for seeing life as meaningful over no reasons at all. In other words, inaccurate or far-fetched beliefs are better than hopelessness. Our need to make sense of things is so strong that we may hold on to a flawed belief system even after we have seen its deficiencies repeatedly. This was what I did. Once you commit to live your life as a person of faith, once you start the journey, faith becomes a part of you that's hard to jettison. We may think of the faith journey like climbing the world's highest peak and looking for anything that will help along the way, as illustrated in the following parable. Frank is about to climb Mount Everest and knows that he is risking his life to do so. On the way to base camp, he stops to pray at a remote temple where he meets a monk. With an air of mysticism, the monk convincingly predicts that Frank will make it to the summit and descend safely, but warns, "There's one thing you must do. You must wear this magic coat I'm giving you. There is no other coat like it. This coat will not only keep you warm, it will empower you to make it to the top. It'll give you courage, endurance, and protection. Only with this coat will you succeed. Without it, you will surely die on the mountain. Frank is mesmerized by the words of the monk. He leaves a generous offering and dons the one-of-a-kind magic coat. A coat that looks like any other, but has hidden powers. Soon, Frank is trudging upward with the other climbers, one of whom is wearing a coat just like his. The climber asks Frank where he got his coat, and upon learning it was from the monk, laughs and asks, "How much did you give him for your magic coat?" The laughing climber explains that the man is not a monk, but a shrewd salesman who has learned that he gets paid the most for a coat when he boasts of its powers, gives it away, and asks for nothing in return. He tells Frank that a number of the climbers who don the monk imposter's magic coats have frozen to death on the mountain. Successfully climbing the world's highest peak is not about wearing a magic garment. It's about conditioning, timing, good decisions, endurance, and luck. But you do need protection from the cold. As much as Frank wants to take off the coat and fling it into the nearest crevasse, he has no other coat to wear. No matter how much the coat reminds him of his gullibility, he needs it to survive the chill of the wind. He doesn't need the coat to be magic, he just needs it to keep him warm. Without the coat, he will die. He doesn't stop wearing the coat because it is all he has. Once faith becomes the way you cope with challenges, pain, and problems, once a community of faith becomes your support system, and once you have disavowed all other avenues for finding meaning, it's hard to disconnect. It's hard to take off the coat. Proofs of the illogical nature of faith, arguments that science makes more sense than religion, and the idea that a true God would reveal himself more clearly and precisely simply do not matter. None of these arguments will likely sway a person who continues to feel that faith is working. When a sense of hope, comfort, and community have been provided, it's hard to even consider removing the magic coat of faith. In this context, the fear of feeling disheartened or alone can easily triumph over logical thinking. As a minister, I learned that adults are more open to spiritual shifts when they go through extreme stress. Dramatic adjustments in religious preferences are not typically made when adults gain some new logical insight, but more often when they feel overwhelmed by life. I think back to my church in New Jersey. And he mentions a few people from earlier in the book here. Wendell became a believer after his wife committed suicide. Vic and Cheryl came to church when their marriage was falling apart. These adults didn't wake up one day with a new theological insight that drew them to Christianity, but rather, they were facing major life events that overwhelmed them and consequently opened them to thinking about new possibilities. Leaving faith as an adult is no different and is more likely to occur when a believer experiences a stressful life event and finds faith lacking. The stressful life event could be a broken relationship, a death, an ethical failure, a career loss. For me, the straw that broke the camel's back was being unable to find a place for spiritual healing when I was most broken. I stayed too long. But at least I left and started over. Again, that's from the book Goodbye Jesus, An Evangelical Preacher's Journey Beyond Faith, written by Tim Sledge, a guy who preached in Illinois, Tennessee, New Jersey, Arizona, Houston, Texas, New York, a guy who launched groundbreaking church support ministries that sort of caught fire and were used by organizations like the Southern Baptist Convention, a pastor who was the real deal, not a pretender, but a real, genuine, to-the-bone believing pastor who at some point in his life realized that the stuff he was preaching made no sense. And now he spends a whole lot of his time and energy dissecting his former faith and just helping people. Yeah, I was looking at his story. And he and I mean, I wasn't a preacher. I was a Christian broadcaster. But Tim and I, we covered a lot of the same ground, you know, religious student leader, you know, this sort of noble, spiritual teenager that was supposed to represent a generation getting into ministry and then spending decades in the ministry before finally looking around going, hey, wait a minute, right? I mean, I really, in a lot of ways, relate to Tim's story. And whether you're one of those people, you know, who came out of the faith, who crawled out of the cocoon, whether it took you, you know, 2 weeks or 20 years, or maybe you're just a lifelong heathen and you're wondering how all this happens. Like, how does somebody believe this stuff in the first place? How does someone become a pastor? How does someone become an ex-pastor? If that kind of stuff fascinates you, you'll want to hang on in just a second. I'll be speaking with ex-pastor Tim Sledge about his story, about his ministry, and about his life after religion. We'll do it in just a second. My friends, here is an ultimate life hack. Because free time is sometimes not all that free, right? It's sometimes hard to feel like we have all the time we want for personal development. There's a great app that solves this problem. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, tablet, or web browser. It takes the best key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books and condenses them down to 15-minute blinks that you can read or listen to. You know, successful people read a lot of books, and it's just a great option for busy people. Or maybe you just want the main points of a book before deciding whether or not to dive in further to the full text. You know, you finally have time to read the books you want. I mean, when I'm out walking Linus around the block, that's about 15 minutes. That's a whole book I can digest in one outing. It's also great in the car, right? A whole book on a single drive. Blinkist makes it possible. I've enjoyed Tim Ferriss's book called The 4-Hour Work Week, getting into the whole work smarter, not harder thing. Blinkist also has Richard Dawkins' new one called Outgrowing God. It's kind of an introduction to why we reject religion and God claims. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want and all for one low price. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Seth. Try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Seth, to start your free 7-day trial. And you'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/Seth. Tim Sledge is a former Southern Baptist pastor. Oh, I love to talk to ex-pastors. They have such good stories. He has written several books, including Goodbye Jesus, An Evangelical Preacher's Journey Beyond Faith, How to Live a Meaningful Life, Focusing on Things That Matter, and 4 Disturbing Questions with One Simple Answer, Breaking the Spell of Christian Belief. The author joins me here, Tim Sledge. Great to have you, my friend.
Thank you, Seth. Glad to be here.
So don't take this wrong, but you sound like a Baptist pastor.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot.
It's funny, those of us who come out of the faith, I don't know if we have a cadence to the way we speak or the way we phrase things, the language we use. Do you catch that a lot? Man, you sound like somebody who preached for 30 years, right?
Well, some, yeah. Not as much as I used to. It's funny, I worked really hard. You should have heard me when I still lived in West Texas.
Really?
But then I went to Wheaton College, and people were mocking me constantly about my Texas accent. So I worked really hard, but you know, your comment today is well received, and it's a testament. It's a testament to the fact that you just can't purify yourself completely.
No matter how hard you try. It wasn't a backhanded kind of thing. I'm just saying. when I hear you, you remind me of a lot, because I spent a lot of time in Baptist churches, And I've sat through a lot of sermons, you know, when I hear people who are, they kind of have that flavor. Can you tell me about how you became a pastor? A lot of people are curious about your story. You can start wherever you want, but what's the deal?
Well, I grew up in a home with an alcoholic dad. And like a lot of alcoholics, he was actually a really good man and most of the time a really good dad, but he was a binge alcoholic. And so my life from my earliest years was very unpredictable and unstable. One moment it was a happy family, everything's great, and then everything just went chaotic. And that led to when I was 8 years old, I got a Bible as a gift from my Sunday school class at the Avenue D Baptist Church in Snyder, Texas. And I noticed that in the back it had a plan by which you could read the whole Bible in 1 year. So on January the 1st, I made a New Year's resolution and I said, I'm going to read the whole Bible. And I read a little bit from the Old Testament in the morning. In the afternoon or evening, I read from the New Testament. And during that year, during Vacation Bible School, when I was 9 years old, we had the Thursday morning event where the pastor got us all together and said, how many of you want to give your life to Jesus? How many of you want to say no to hell? If you'd like to do that, and everybody, of course, has their heads bowed and their eyes closed, just raise your hand. So you'd raise your hand. And if you raise your hand, say this prayer with me. And then the final step was going down the aisle. And with a lot of hesitation and fear and anxiety, I walked the aisle that day. And that was the beginning of my Christian life. And then when I was 16 years old, we had moved to another West Texas town, Odessa, Texas. That's the home of the Friday Night Lights football team. And I had a great pastor. He was a man who went on to be a national leader among Southern Baptists in later years. And he became sort of a second father to me. One Sunday morning during the invitation at the end of the service, you know, where they sing a song and ask you to make a decision for Jesus and walk the aisle, I felt a strange emotional stirring. And I talked to my pastor about it later. What is this? What's happening? And his words were, well, you know, we really can't say for sure what that stirring was, but you just need to tell God that whatever he wants you to do, you'll do. So that day I prayed, God, wherever you want me to go, I'll go. Whatever you want me to be, I'll be. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And a few months later, we had a revival, and I felt another stirring, and I felt called to preach. I walked the aisle, made the decision public in front of my congregation, and 2 weeks later, I preached my first sermon. And soon, during the last 2 years of high school, I was preaching almost every week in some church in West Texas. And they weren't just Baptist churches. I got invitations to preach in Methodist churches, Assembly of God, all kinds of churches. And in my senior year, I was elected president of my student body. I organized a citywide youth rally. We rented the county coliseum, and on a Saturday night, I preached to 1,200 teenagers. At the end of the sermon, 50 came forward to make decisions for Jesus. And I thought I was on my way to becoming the next Billy Graham.
Can I ask what the attraction was for these churches? Was it your youth? Because, you know, you're not a seminary graduate, right? You're not a degree monger at this point. You're a teenager. Was it that this person's going to represent the next generation for Jesus kind of thing?
I think it was that. It turned out I had a gift for speaking. But I think it was, this is what we want our young people to be. The unfortunate part of it is, I mean, I had a lot of fun growing up. I was a pretty strict Baptist, but I had a great, actually a wonderful teenage life. But in some senses, I became an adult too soon. And that's, of course, an issue for children of alcoholics. And I was the hero. That was my role. And so I skipped part of being an adolescent.
So, you know, you're behind the pulpit for 30 years. Tell me about that.
I ended up at Wheaton College, did my last 2 years at Wheaton College. Primary reason, that was Billy Graham's alma mater. And I think most young preachers, at least conservative preachers in those days, wanted to be like Billy Graham, and I was no exception. during my first year there, one of Graham's associates' daughter was graduating, and I found myself sitting in chapel three rows from Billy Graham himself. And I had to pinch myself. I couldn't believe it. So I graduated from Wheaton with a degree in Bible. And then I went back to Texas and went to Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, where I got my master's and doctor of ministry degrees, majoring in pastoral care. I was already starting to see this is a little more complex than just walking the aisle, giving your life to Jesus. I was already seeing that, you know, Christians still have problems. And so for me, psychology and counseling within the context of the church was a way to address this. And so that's why I majored in pastoral care. And my first church was in a suburb of New York City. Imagine that, a Southern Baptist church on the edge of New York City in New Jersey. And but I looked at it like, well, I'm a shoe salesman and hardly anybody around here wears shoes. So let's go after it.
What kind of sermons are we talking about? I mean, you were a straight Southern Baptist, Bible literalist, there is a heaven, there is a fire and brimstone hell kind of thing?
Yes and no. Wheaton College, regardless of the, I mean, it was the bastion of Christian conservatism, but it was the high end intellectually. I mean, that was the calling card. And actually, there have been many years where Wheaton, a relatively small school, has been a leader in the number of graduates who went on to get PhDs, often in, and not in religious fields necessarily, but more often in science and other more secular areas. So it was kind of a contradictory atmosphere because there was a lot of culture and a lot of good scholarship. I wasn't a typical Southern Baptist when I came back from Wheaton. I had a broader view of other denominations. But at first, like when I was in high school, I remember when I first started preaching and I was in some little church in some West Texas town. And if I really hit it hard, like if I said, if you don't give your life to Jesus, you're going to spend your eternity in hell, I'd get some amens from the back. And what I started to realize, like a comedian who's trying out his jokes and he finds out, you know, where he gets to laugh every time. So I learned that the more assured I was of what I said, the more confident I sounded, and the more I took a hard line, there's no denying this, you give your life to Jesus or else, that's what worked. And so at first, man, I was hardcore. But going to school softened that. And then when I went to seminary and majored in pastoral care, I was kind of an odd hybrid, still preaching that basic message, everybody needs Jesus, and without Jesus, you're going to spend eternity suffering. But by the time I was in my third church in 1985, I went to a church in the suburbs of Houston. By this point, I was preaching a lot of sermons about practical help. You know, how do you deal with worry? How do you be a good friend to other people? And then during that time, and it actually occurred on my 40th birthday, there were a lot of books being written about adult children of alcoholics. And I had a cousin who had been a drug addict and an alcoholic who had been sober and clean for many years. And he kept telling me, Tim, you should go to the treatment center where I went out in Arizona, the Meadows, because they have a program for ministers and you can go there for a week and they want you just pay for your room and your food, but they won't charge you any of the normal fees. And I'd always just blow it off like, man, I don't need to go to a place where alcoholics go. No, thank you. But as I was planning for this sermon series, I thought, wow, what a good way to get some material for these sermons I'm going to do, because I decided I was going to do a whole series on adult children of alcoholics. And so I decided, I'm going to go. I went to the Meadows and I found myself in a group of about seven or eight people who were introducing themselves on a Monday morning with statements like, hello, I'm Jane, I'm a recovering alcoholic, drug addict. Hello, I'm Mike. I'm a recovering alcoholic, sex addict, and on and on. And by the time it was almost my turn, I thought, I've got to get out of here. These people are really messed up. What am I doing here? And but I stayed, and it was life-changing, because before the week was over, I had a different understanding of what it meant to be an adult child of an alcoholic, and I got in touch with a deep level of emotional pain. I was able to talk about it, to feel it, to let it out. It revolutionized my life, but it was probably also the beginning of the end, and the end didn't take place until about 20 years later, but that was probably the beginning of the end. And the reason was, I went back and I preached the sermon series, and while I was doing the sermons, I started a group. I wanted to have a group where I had about 5 or 6 people, and we'd talk about it. I wanted to duplicate what I'd seen at the Meadows, and since my studies in seminary were in psychology and pastoral care, I felt like I was ready for the task. When the sign-up night came, we had enough people for 6 groups, not just one. The sermons went very well. The religion editor of the Houston Chronicle came and did an interview with me, did a big front page of the family life section of the paper on what was happening. And then people started coming from all over the city, from other denominations, from AA groups, everything. And I wrote a book called Making Peace with Your Past that became the workbook for these support groups that we did. And soon I found myself traveling all around the country, talking to people in churches about my experience, our churches, groups, adult children, and how to start a support group ministry in your church. And Lifeway, the Southern Baptist publishing arm, began publishing a whole series of workbooks for all different kinds of support groups. I wrote another book for them called Moving Beyond Your Past, which was the follow-up for the first one. So in this process of, first of all, in our local church, we were already growing before this happened, but our growth exploded. And suddenly we had 2 churches within one congregation. And the second congregation, the second church, so to speak, these were broken people. These were people who had been through all kinds of things. And if you walk past one of their meetings on a Sunday morning, we had a special Sunday school class for them, you'd see people hugging, you'd see people with tears in their eyes. You'd see people engaged in deep conversations. But across the hall, if the adult Sunday school was letting out, you'd see people, it was good. I mean, they were laughing, they were talking about the game that would be on TV that afternoon. But you had a real sense that something a lot deeper was happening in the former group. And I started to relate more to these people. They were so honest. And in our groups, we were really honest. And the thing that I started having to admit was this. Giving your life to Jesus. And the scripture says, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. All things have been, the old has passed away. All things have become new. And that was my belief. Conversion is, it's you're born again. You become a new person. The Holy Spirit comes to live inside of you. You begin to bear the fruits of the Spirit. And then, of course, when you start in the ministry, you realize real soon, okay, it's not that simple. And then there's always an answer, though, like, well, you have to disciple them. You have to teach them the Word of God. You have to teach them to pray. And so I'd done all those things, but now, at age 40 and in the few years after that, I was seeing over and over that people who have emotional problems from their past, those problems don't go away just because you gave your life to Jesus. You need help just like anybody else. You need to talk about it. You need to work through it. You need to feel the hurt and move on. And that started to bother me more and more. Like, wow, these groups actually, from what I'm seeing, they're more life-changing than anything else we're doing. By the time I'd been at the church for 10 years, our membership had quadrupled. We were growing at a rate multiple times faster than the community in which our church was located. And we were doing all kinds of creative ministry. And one of the things I did, I got together a group of 4 deacons to be my support and accountability group. I felt that if I was going to be consistent about the things I was asking other people to do, then I needed to do that, and I needed to be accountable to the deacons in my church. In the process of meeting with this group, I was going through burnout because I'd written actually 3 books in about 3 years. I was traveling all over the country. Our church was growing rapidly. And my family was going through some issues. And so as I got more and more honest with this deacon support and accountability group, one day I broke down. I was just exhausted and discouraged, and I just let it all out. And to me, in our support groups, that was normal. You do that and everybody, they support you, they listen, and you go on with life. But I don't know if it scared those men, none of whom had ever participated in any of our recovery ministries at church. And pretty soon, coming from this group and one of the men in the group who was the chairman of our personnel committee, they said, "Tim, we want you to leave, and we want you to tell the church that God is leading you to leave." This spread out over several months, and it ended up with a Wednesday night business meeting that followed a Saturday meeting with the personnel committee and my lawyer, in which we hammered out an agreement that I would resign, that the church would specify in writing that there were no moral or ethical issues involved in my being asked to leave, and that I would be paid for 10 months. My wife, who was also on the staff, would leave, and neither of us would ever attend the church again, ever. So on that Wednesday night, I spoke for a few minutes, and all the while I was thinking, man, I don't get it. Our church is growing. Every week people tell me how much they're being touched and changed, and I really missed something. But after I spoke that night, about 80% of the people present stood and gave me a standing ovation. That's when I knew I'd been tricked. My burnout, my exhaustion, my discouragement had been taken advantage of. But by then, I was so sickened by what I'd seen that I didn't want to stay. And so that was the end of my pastoral ministry there. And I decided, none of my friends believed me, but I said, I'm never going to be a pastor again. I'll write, I'll travel and speak, I'll still be a Christian, but I'm done with being a pastor. It was a very painful, sad event. And not too many years, it actually started almost immediately, but the recovery ministry faded away, and one of the laymen who had become a leader actually started a similar ministry in another church in the area that's sort of taken its place. The church became more traditional. Our denomination was being taken over by far-right fundamentalists, and they're the same kind of mentality that we see in the news today, and the same kind of evangelicals who elected our current president. And so the church I was super conservative, but they went to the right, really, really, and even farther. And I think that's probably where they are today.
I remember back in, was the 80s and 90s, and it continues to a degree today, big rifts in the Southern Baptist Convention, right? Who are we? Who do we accept? What do we preach? And you were witness to that, probably front and center, right? You saw the sort of factions within the Southern Baptist Convention. What did that look like from your vantage?
Well, I talk about that in some detail in Goodbye Jesus. It was crazy making. I mean, I graduated from Wheaton College. At first, I thought I was one of them. But then, as I started watching the fundamentalists in our denominational battle, they were mean. They lied. They wanted power, and many of them weren't very smart. It's ironic that two of the key figures in the movement, and this took years and years to unfold, but one, I think, is sort of faded into obscurity after a young man who worked with him accused him of homosexual abuse. And it's never been clarified, but it keeps resurfacing. My gut is, it's true. just based on everything I've seen and on my own brief encounters with this individual myself. And then another key figure in the movement ended up the president of the seminary that I graduated from and was removed because he failed to, I mean, and these are the fundamentalists who removed him because he failed to take action when it was reported that someone under his administration had sexually harassed or abused a woman. These were not, at the heart of things, good people. And this is to me reflective of the national scene today in the United States, where you have these people who are advocating, go all the way with your commitment, take the right view on everything, and then they articulate what is right, but then you look under the surface and they're supporting things that are not good. It was saddening, but by the time it was in the latter stages, I was gradually moving away. I did a lot of speaking in regard to support groups. I decided I never wanted to be dependent on my income from a church again. So I started doing some things in business and ended up with my own business developing computer software for businesses. And I've been doing that since 1996, 97.
I'm interested in the splintering. You know, this is supposedly the God who's not the author of confusion. And yet even within the Baptist culture, denomination, Southern Baptist and evangelical free will, I mean, just there's so many factions and then factions within those factions. And it's interesting to see, you know, we can't seem to get congruence on basic theology. You know, how do you baptize? What is hell? What's that look like? Does it even exist? Do you get the Holy Spirit at the moment of your salvation prayer? Is that a separate prayer? Speaking in tongues? Is that for yesterday or today? All of these, do miracles happen like they happened in Jesus' time, or are they different? You probably navigated some of these questions in your own journey, right?
Oh, yes. And my perspective on it today is, okay, this tells us there is something wrong with the source book, the Bible, and there's something wrong with prayer, because prayer is talking to God. And, you know, the most devout believers, I think of the hymn, In the Garden, and he walks with me and he talks with me. I don't know any devout Christian who doesn't think that God speaks to them in prayer, not eardrum rattling speaking, but, you know, the still small voice, the sense of guidance. So if God delivered his message to the world through the Bible or through the acts of the prophets and Jesus as recorded in the Bible, and prayer is talking to God, why are there thousands of denominations? Why is there no agreement? Why don't all Christians have a world day of prayer? We're going to talk to God today, and he's going to clear up all these doctrinal differences, and we expect to be one unified church within a few weeks after this day of prayer.
What did doubt feel like? You have some guilt? Were you afraid? I don't know. I mean, you tell me. What was going on when all of a sudden 2 + 2 didn't equal 5?
It was a long, slow process. It started when I was a youth, a college preacher preaching revivals in the summer. I preached at a church. A young man had a dramatic conversion. I went back to the church a year later, and I don't remember his name, but I said, where's Sam? And they said, who? And so I just, don't you remember the guy? He came forward a year ago, and he was so dramatic. And he said, oh, he came for a few weeks and then disappeared. And I was like, what? I mean, I was so naive. And then at my first church in the New York City area, a man showed up one day. He was an interesting figure. I don't know if you remember years ago, the I'd rather fight than switch cigarette ads. Everybody had a black eye, and it was kind of stupid, but he was on the back cover of Newsweek magazine. He was the model for one of those ads, but he showed up at my church and his life had fallen apart. Soon he and his wife had prayed to receive Christ, another dramatic conversion. A few months later, I was on vacation and I called one of the deacons to see how everything was back at the church. And I said, how's it going? And he said, well, the convert's name was Dave. He said, Dave robbed a bank. I said, what? Dave robbed a bank. He had run out of money. He got a fake pistol, robbed a bank. And I spent quite a number of meaningful visits, deep conversations with Dave in Sing Sing Prison, up the river, as they call it. So this was like, wait a minute. Man, he seemed really sincere when he prayed. And then, but what you do is you say, well, okay, he wasn't discipled. I mean, there's always an answer. There's a thousand answers, more than a thousand. You always go to the next level. Well, it's like you buy a car and they make all these promises. And then when it breaks down, they pull out all the fine print. That's the way faith works. So to answer your question, doubt didn't feel like doubt most of the time. It was just one more question to put on the back burner, because when I study more and I have more experience, I'll be able to figure this out. But when I had studied more and I did have more experience, no, I still don't have an answer. I still don't know. And then things started to go downhill in other ways after several years after I stopped being a pastor. But it was like a drip, drip, drip.
I always say it's like coming out of a coma. You know, it doesn't happen immediately. It takes a while to regain consciousness for a great many of us. And then we look around and go, why did it take me so long? Did you ever have that conversation? What's wrong with me? Yeah, how come it took me decades?
not only that, but how could I have believed that?
Yeah.
It's so simple to look at it and say, that doesn't add up. It's kind of embarrassing.
But, you know, we have to cut ourselves a little slack, right? I mean, the power of indoctrination, the power of our culture and communities. I mean, you know, this, they hit you young, right? They hit both of us when we were pretty young and pretty impressionable.
Yes. And then there's the fact that I was pretty good at doing the indoctrinating. And that's one reason I've written my books, and it's one reason I'm online on Twitter. But, you know, part of my recovery and emotional health perspective is I don't let myself wallow in shame or guilt. I can't undo the past, but I can tell the truth as I see it now.
Tim, tell me about the title of this book, Four Disturbing Questions with One Simple Answer. I mean, I don't want to spill the beans, but you got four disturbing questions? Well, I mean, what are you talking about?
Well, in Goodbye Jesus, it's my spiritual autobiography, and I tell my story. And then in the about the last one-fourth of the book, I chronicle the step-by-step breakdown of my faith. And I've gotten good responses to the book, but it's a pretty big commitment. It's 420 pages, and it goes into a lot of detail. So after that book, I decided I wanted to write a book that was easy to read, quick, short book that got down to what I felt were the most pressing questions. And I won't give away all of them, but the third question is what I call the germ warfare question. Why didn't Jesus say anything about germs? Jesus is referred to as the great physician, and a big deal is made about how he healed people. And some parts of the Christian world, as you know, emphasize healing even today, although I did read that Benny Hinn has shut down his healing services until further notice when the coronavirus pandemic is slowing down.
What's that line about why aren't the faith healers leaving their church auditoriums and actually visiting the hospitals? It's a salient question, I think. Yeah.
Right, right. So I look back and I ask this question, well, okay, let's start with the premise that Jesus was the Son of God. He was God's message, one time, once for all, most important message to all of humanity for all of time. Why didn't he say anything about germs? Instead, he led people to believe that hand washing wasn't important. Now, I don't want to take this out of context, but it was a scene where he was asked, well, why don't you and your disciples wash your hands like other devout Jewish people? And he was certainly talking about the importance of real core changes in your values and your attitudes versus ritual. So he said, it's not important what goes into your body. It's important what comes out, like what you say and what you do. So there's a good message there. But for someone who truly understood that one of the greatest battles humanity is going to fight is with these invisible living things that can kill us, sometimes tens or hundreds of thousands of humans at a time across the world, wouldn't it have made sense that such a being would have said, okay, I need to get this message across about ritual, but I sure don't want to tell people that washing your hands is unimportant. He could have healed and prolonged the lives of countless times more people by just saying something like, hey, I can't fully explain this right now, but wash your hands and be careful which water you drink. But he didn't say those things because he was a man, a Jewish apocalyptic prophet who died 2,000 years ago. Simple. That's the simple answer right there.
I'm guessing you've been watching almost like into a terrarium, right, with all the sort of name it and claim it types, believing in the power of prayer. They're claiming the power of divine healing, the power of God doing miracles today. And yet we see the instances of COVID-19 continuing to escalate exponentially. And this then becomes a referendum, doesn't it, on the power of prayer?
Yes. And I think that prayer may be the Achilles heel of faith as far as a skeptical attack on faith. So let's look at COVID-19. The statement Christians make is, we're praying for you. So what does that mean? If you don't get coronavirus, they'll say, see, God was shielding you. We prayed for you and God shielded you. If you do get it and you get well, they'll say, praise God. He heard our prayers. He healed you. If you get it and you die, they'll say, God has a higher purpose. And my take on that is, you know what? You could get the same results praying to a telephone pole. If you ask the telephone pole, please help me during this pandemic. Same three responses, they still work. And so that leads me to say, isn't the pole good?
All hail the pole. Yeah, I like
right.
that. It's an odd, it's almost like, I don't know, I just got a flash from Planet of the Apes when they're all hailing the bomb. That's a whole other context.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, no, yeah. Sorry about that. That's how my mind works. I'm like a gnat flying in every direction at the same time. You know? Well, you know, it's convenient too because, and I did a video about this years and years ago, right? If there's a gang shooting and somebody, you know, they drive by and they shoot out the window at someone. If he escapes without injury, it was God defending him or deflecting the bullets. If he's injured but not killed, he should have been killed. It's a miracle. If he's paralyzed, well, at least he's still alive. If he's dead, God took him to a place where there is no pain and no death, and one day we'll all be reunited. It's this really convenient sort of silly putty deity that has been created to be molded into whatever shape they need to deal.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons my subtitle is Breaking the Spell of Christian Belief. You're under a spell. It's as if you're under a spell, and the obvious points of logic are invisible to you. At the same time, and I've appreciated things I've been hearing you say recently about this topic, I believe that we need to be kind to people. And online, I see some people who say religion is insanity.
Yeah.
All preachers are con artists and all this kind of stuff. Most preachers I know are sincere, could have made more money doing something else than what they did. And probably, well, I don't know, percentages are harder here, but most Christians I know, especially the devout ones, they were sincere, good people. One of my best friends who somehow hung in there with me through all this, and we talk every week. He's a devout Christian. We disagree, on this basic issue. And I understand that prayer makes people feel better. I just don't think it's based on truth. So I try to strike a balance between saying what I saw. I was right in the middle of this for decades. I spent more time in a church building than anywhere else. So I have something to say. I had a front row seat, and I feel like I'm in the Wizard of Oz, and the curtain got pulled back, and I saw the little man behind the controls making all those fantastic things occur. And actually, there were a lot of little men, and I was one of them. And so I have something to say, and I'm going to say it directly and in ways that sometimes offend people. But at the same time, I'm trying to walk that fine line face to face, in person, or even as I interact with people online. I want to show respect. I want other people to have the right to decide what they believe, but I want to have the right to disagree and to say what I believe is true at this point now.
Did you catch a lot of that? You were never a true, no one who ever truly knew Jesus Christ would ever walk away. You catch a lot of that sort of?
Oh, yeah. I'd say the reactions are to shun you, to judge you, or to pity you. And my least favorite is the pity, I have to say. No thanks. To use a Christian expression, I'm in a better place now.
Well, yeah, a lot of times when they look at you and say, bless your heart, it really comes off as pure condescension and kind of a conversation stopper, right? I'm sorry you're so wounded or that you're so misguided. I'll stand here on my perch on the high mountain and I will offer up prayers to on high for you. It's not... They're not saying, bless your heart. They're saying,
that's right.
You're an idiot.
That's right, exactly right. And here's what just boggles my mind. What I'm doing now, what my position now is considered arrogant. Now, I used to believe the God of the universe was my best friend, was talking to me and guiding me and had a special plan for my life. But now that I no longer believe that, and I think I'm a speck of dust in a vast universe who will cease to exist when I die, now I'm arrogant. I don't get that.
You weren't adopted by an all-powerful king to go on a divine crusade with eternal reward, and somehow you're the arrogant one.
Right.
On this side of the looking glass, I mean, this, I know the answer to the question because I can hear it in your voice and I'm familiar with your work, but, you know, no regrets. You don't miss, you wouldn't go back to the Matrix kind of thing, plug back in where life was a little more, I don't know, at least assured that you would live forever and all that stuff.
Well, certainly I would like it better if I was going to live forever, I think, although I don't know what are you going to do forever. But if I could take a pill and get my faith back, I wouldn't. I wouldn't do it because what I believed was not based on truth. I do miss the sense of community. And I think that the secular community, which is very diverse and sort of disjointed, I don't know if this can or will happen, but it seems to me there's an opportunity today for some younger leaders to develop secular communities that understand that much of what churches do has nothing to do with deity. It has to do with what it means to be human, the need for community, the need to share life with other humans, the need to share the important transition points of life with people who care. And there are communities who are doing that. But I think it's harder, and this is, there's a real irony here. One of my favorite books these days is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. And he talks about the power of story and how stories build cultures. Communities are built on stories. And so in the secular community, I don't know that we found our story. It doesn't lend itself. There's something powerful about this humble man came to the earth. He lived. He died on the cross. He died for our sins. He rose again, and he wants to live in your heart. That's a pretty good story. So I do miss that sense of being involved with a group of people on a mission. I really did want to make the world a better place. So there are some things that I miss, but couldn't go back, don't want to go back for one simple reason. It doesn't add up and it's not based on truth.
You'd rather live a harder reality than a happy fantasy. Would that be a fair way to say it?
Yeah, very fair.
Tim Sledge, he is author of several books. What's the best way for my listeners to find more of your work and to get to know your stuff better?
You can Google my name, Tim Sledge, T-I-M-S-L-E-D-G-E, or you can go to Amazon.com and do a search under my name or search for Goodbye Jesus, and all my books are on sale there, and they'll pop up when you do the search.
I'm glad you escaped. Love to hear stories of people who sort of climbed out. You know, I mean, you left on your own terms, you're living an authentic life, and you're helping other people to do the same. And in that way, for whatever it's worth to you, you know, you're still making a difference. You're still making the world a better place, which is what you always wanted to do. So thanks so much, Tim Sledge, for your work, man.
Thanks, Seth. I enjoyed our talk today.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.